They were very minor incidents.
President Trump did the interview with Hannity in the Oval Office. Five police officers who served at the Capitol on January 6 died in the days and weeks after the attack. A total of 140 police officers were assaulted by Trump supporters that day. On Wednesday, former Washington, D.C. police officer Michael Fanone criticized the pardons for the rioters. Fanone suffered a heart attack and a traumatic brain injury after he was beaten and electrocuted with a taser while trying to defend the Capitol.
I made my way to the front line, and at one point, I was pulled off the police line by an individual. His name is Albuquerque Head. He's from Tennessee. He put me in a chokehold and pulled me out into the crowd. And if you watch my body-worn camera footage, you'll hear him yell out, "I've got one." Once I was out in the crowd, you know, I was beaten, restrained. At one point, an individual, Kyle Young, lunged at me while I was being restrained and attempted to remove my firearm from its holster. All while, you know, other individuals were, you know, kind of egging him on, telling him to kill me with my gun. Another individual, Daniel Rodriguez, used a taser device, applied it to my neck numerous times. And finally, Thomas Sibick stripped me of my badge and my radio, all while I was being, again, restrained and beaten. These are the individuals that pled guilty and were sentenced. And Donald Trump saw it fit to pardon them.
That was former Washington, D.C. police officer Michael Fanone, who suffered a heart attack and a traumatic brain injury after he was beaten and electrocuted with a taser while trying to defend the Capitol. We're joined now by the son of one of the January 6th insurrectionists who was just pardoned. Jackson Reffitt's father, Guy Reffitt, was the first person to be convicted over January 6th. Guy Reffitt was a member of a far-right militia called the Texas Three Percenters. During his trial, jurors were shown video of Reffitt filming himself saying, "Drag those people out of the Capitol by their ankles. I just want to see Pelosi's head hit every effing stair on the way out, and leader Mitch McConnell, too."
It was Guy Reffitt's own son, Jackson, who tipped the FBI off about his dad after January 6th. Jackson Reffitt now fears for his life after Trump pardoned his father and 1,500 others involved in the insurrection. Jackson has already received numerous death threats. Jackson Reffitt joins us now from an undisclosed location. Hi, Jackson. Thanks so much for being with us. Can you talk about what your father did at the time, what you reported, and why you're so afraid right now?
Well, at the time, my father was really getting into all this, 3% or militia movement following the events of 2020 leading into 2021. And that quickly escalated in 2020, bleeding into January 6th, you know, talking about what he's going to do. So I informed the FBI just to alleviate a lot of the paranoia and unknowingness that I had at that time. And I didn't realize it, but until January 5th, when he left, I did not know he committed to going to something like January 6th. And he was already on the way. And he then stormed up the Capitol steps with body armor, zip cuffs, and a handgun on his side, and came home clicking his heels in joy and validation over what had happened. And it was a terrifying moment in my life to think that that happened and happened to our family. It's unreal to even think about now.
So, Jackson, how do you understand why your father was drawn to these groups?
I understand it to be, you know, the fear-mongering that the Trump administration really put on these people. You know, I understand capitalism can atomize people and families and make them feel so alone and destroyed. But, you know, post-2016, my family really hit a huge crisis when the price of oil collapsed. My father lost his job from overseas. And when we hit back in America, I mean, we were picking up bed frames off the side of the road, you know, and sleeping on the same blow up mattress, you know, downloading movies from Netflix, bringing them home and watching them on the TV because we had no internet. And leading from the Trump administration from 2016 onwards, you know, my father really gripped onto what Trump was saying, really gathered what he was offering and trying to give to my family. Of course, you know, that only led to him running up the steps of the Capitol with a gun on his waist and years in prison. But, you know, I understand it to be that he was trying to defend my family and do what he thought was right. But, you know, that inevitably led to what it is now.
Well, and Jackson, but following this pardon, you said that, quote, I can't imagine what he's going to be willing to do now. It could get a whole hell of a lot worse. Explain what you fear might happen.
So to look at how I'm feeling now, we have to look back post January 6, 2021, is my dad came home more proud than ever for doing something that a man who never knew he existed told him to do. And now he knows he exists. Donald Trump gave him that presidential pardon to validate and justify his actions. And the validation now, I'm sure, is swimming through the crowds of the people who participated in January 6th. Like, that is dangerous, you know, to justify actions like that and to completely validate them is going to be deadly. Not only for me, my situation is explosive and some would call a dramatic, you know, visualization of what's going on in this country. But there are thousands and thousands of people who are just like me, who do not have the same privilege I do of being able to drop everything, move, buy a handgun. All this stuff is very lucky for me to have the opportunity to secure myself. Other people don't have that luxury, and I fear so much for them.
On Tuesday, former Oath Keepers leader Stuart Rhodes spoke to reporters after his 18-year prison sentence was commuted by Trump. He went back to the scene of the crime, to the Capitol.
I feel vindicated and validated. Yes, absolutely. Of course, I haven't gotten a pardon yet. I got commutation. But I'm applying for one. I'm pretty positive I'll get one. When they review my case, they'll understand that I was targeted for who I am, not for anything I did.
So Stuart Rhodes' sentence was commuted. He's pushing for a full pardon. That means he can get guns. Jackson, if you could explain why you are so afraid of your dad. Do you fear your father pardoned? He can get weapons. We just showed a picture of him together with Stuart Rhodes. Do you fear he will go after you, that he will kill you? Has he ever threatened that?
Well, first off, I want to say that this is the first time I'm hearing that clip with Stuart Rhodes, and that's flabbergasting to hear. You know, I've been saying this stuff about validation and justification. That clip just, you know, dropped my stomach. That was terrifying to actually hear a member say that. But when it comes to my father, yes, of course, I'm terrified of all this stuff. I have nothing but paranoia and unknowingness about what's going to happen in the future, other than what I've heard and witnessed and seen my father and my mother get further and further radicalized throughout these years. I was ignorant when I was 18 when all this happened, to think that prison would distance himself from these militias. And his final testimony to the judge, he begged and pleaded that he was never going to participate in this far-right militia nonsense. But he's just been isolated and put into an echo chamber of these people that are going to validate and justify him. So I have no idea what my father is thinking right now. He can say whatever he wants, but his actions are the real thing that matter. And his actions have not shown any sort of growth. It is shown a further and further hole, a rabbit hole. You know, I love my father deeply, but this is not a healthy thing to dive into.
I want to bring another guest into this conversation to talk more about Trump's January 6th pardons. We're joined by former FBI Special Agent Mike German, who once worked undercover in white supremacist and militia groups. He's a fellow with the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School. He has a new book out. It's called Policing White Supremacy, The Enemy Within. Mike German is joining us from San Diego. Mike, welcome back to Democracy Now! As you listen to Jackson, and we look at who was on those steps and inside the Capitol, particularly the violent people, on the one hand, you have 140 officers who were injured. You have five who died in the days that followed, two by suicide, another after being gassed. You have the ones that were so seriously injured, like Fanon. And on the other side, you also had officers and sheriffs, a number of cops and military, even active duty, were in that crowd. Talk about your findings.
Thanks for having me, Amy. I think the pardons definitely send a message both to the far-right militant movement that political violence against Trump's enemies will be rewarded by the highest office in the land. And it also sends a message to law enforcement that there's no value in investigating and prosecuting far-right violence. Unfortunately, far-right violence has been something that law enforcement has rarely paid very much attention to. Even to this day, the FBI doesn't track the number of violent white supremacist attacks occur in this country or how many people are killed by those attacks. So this will reinforce what has been a blind spot for the FBI and generally for law enforcement. Obviously, there has been law enforcement support for these movements for some time. In fact, as an FBI agent, I received those warnings before I went undercover that, hey, you have to be careful who you talk to in law enforcement about these cases because there are sympathizers within law enforcement. And nobody on a joint terrorism task force thought that was an odd warning. And likewise, those warnings have been provided since, documented in a 2006 intelligence report and the 2015 FBI counterterrorism policy guide that warns agents investigating domestic terrorism cases against white supremacists that the subjects of their investigations often have active contacts with law enforcement. So this is a problem that's long been understood within law enforcement, but we don't have a national program designed to identify those officers and protect the public from them.
Mike German, so is that the explanation for why, as you said, that white supremacist violence is deprioritized by the FBI and other government agencies? The reason is that they are complicit. There are people within the FBI and these agencies that are complicit with white supremacists?
Not just that, but the white supremacy infects all of our institutions, and that includes prosecutors' offices, that includes judges, that includes corporate boards. Everywhere we see racial disparities that impact communities of color negatively and privilege white and male communities. So, it's not just the law enforcement officers. If we saw it on January 6th, there were a number of current and former law enforcement officers participating, but also current and former military people, members of state and local legislature. So this is a pervasive problem. But law enforcement is supposed to is designed to protect the American public. And here we see President Trump clearly sending the message that these institutions designed to protect the American public are instead going to be used to protect his supporters and target his enemies.
So what's your reading, Mike German, of what the effect of these pardons will be, not just on white supremacist violence, but violence in general, political violence in the U.S.?
And that's really the big problem, is that it's totally unpredictable. You know, once the highest office in the land gives a green light to political violence, it's very hard to predict who is ultimately going to be harmed. And, you know, if you look at some of these recent attacks, including the attempted assassination of President Trump, these are people who are, according to the government's intelligence that they've released, people who have been immersed in these conspiracy theories that Jackson was talking about. And it's all, even when I was in the movement, it was very hard to predict how any one piece of news would be interpreted in this group that, that has a very different sense of reality than the general public. So it will be very disruptive within the far right militant movement as well, because these people who went to prison are now coming out, but others have rebuilt these organizations in their own image, and it's going to be a very difficult period, I'm afraid.
I wanted to end with Jackson. Jackson, you're in an undisclosed location now. Your mother and sisters sided with your father. Only you and your boyfriend know exactly where you are. Your boyfriend, transgender, on his first day back in office, President Trump also moved to roll back protections for the transgender community. Do you think that LGBTQ and transgender issues also drives your father in your fear of what he could do to you?
I don't know anymore. It's been 4 years, you know, leading up, and when, as he spiraled in 2020, it got worse and worse with his, you know, hate towards LGBTQ and queer adjacent people. But, you know, seeing my own mother not be able to handle it, as she also delved into this far right agenda that she pandered to and fed into, I can't imagine how far my father's gotten. I'm terrified to even confront him about it, because I don't know anymore, and I don't want to be hurt like that. I can handle, you know, their frustrations and their anger and how sad they are with me. I want to be there with them with that. I want to be able to work with them on that. But for something like that, with my wonderful partner, my boyfriend, I that is so hard to compromise with. You know, I can handle everything else. I can figure stuff out. I can distance. I can be safe. I have all those options, but when it comes to something like that, that bigoted behavior and language, that terrifies me. And as it's gotten worse throughout the years, I have no idea where it lays now. And I, with something like that, I don't know how to manage.
Well, Jackson, I want to thank you for being with us. You're very brave to speak out from where you are. Jackson Reffitt, his father, Guy Reffitt, just pardoned by Donald Trump for his role in the January 6th insurrection. And Mike, thank you so much. We hope to have you back on soon to talk more about your book and your findings. Former FBI special agent, fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School. Mike Brennan's new book is called Policing White Supremacy, The Enemy Within. Coming up, a ceasefire's largely holding in Gaza, but Israel's intensifying attacks on the occupied West Bank. Back in 20 seconds. وهي ما بدها خاتم ولا بهواها خاتم بدها عالم فلسطيني رفرف على المحاكم هي ما بدها هدية ولا بهواها هدية بدها عالم فلسطيني رفرف على المسكوبية وأنا ما بدي حطة ولا بهواي حطة بدي عالم فلسطيني رفرف عسيج شرطة أنا ما بدي زفة ولا بهواي زفة بدي تبطل فلسطين محصورة بأرض الضفة وهي ما بدها ذهب ولا بهواها ذهب بدها عالم فلسطين
زفت أطخير Liberation Chant by Kalkim. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
While a ceasefire is largely holding in Gaza, Israel is intensifying attacks on the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military has killed at least 13 people in a major military operation targeting Jenin that began on Tuesday when Israeli troops raided the city backed by airstrikes, drones, and Apache helicopters. Meanwhile, Israeli settler groups have carried out a new wave of attacks against Palestinians. On his first day in office, Trump rescinded sanctions imposed by President Biden on far-right Israeli settler groups. This is Jalal Bashir, head of the village council of Jina Safut.
Yesterday, we heard Trump's statement that he would reverse sanctions against settlers that assault Palestinians, along with Israeli minister Itamar Ben-Gvir's release of arrested settlers. This all encourages violence and gives momentum to these attacks on our village.
Joining us now is Mariam Barghouti, Palestinian writer and journalist based in Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Her new piece for Dropsite News headlined Israel invades Jenin days after signing Gaza ceasefire. Talk about that, Mariam, this connection between the ceasefire in Gaza and the intensified attacks on the West Bank and the number of people who've been killed, the role, and particularly if you can talk about doctors and hospitals being targeted.
All right. Thank you, Amy. So what we're seeing right now is an operation dubbed Operation Iron Wall, waged by the Israeli government against the West Bank, specifically targeting Jenin and Jenin refugee camp that is north of the West Bank. And what we have seen in the last 72 hours is 13 Palestinians at least have been killed. Of them is a 16-year-old boy. Now, while the Israeli military spokesperson claims that they have targeted and eliminated 13 terrorists, it is important to recollect and realize that most were civilians that were killed, including a young 16-year-old boy, including a father who was killed in front of his son. And we're seeing reports of field executions. But in fact, we actually don't know the real number of those killed or injured because the Israeli military is denying access to medical personnel inside the camp. So we're seeing Israel wage a war that very much resembles the practices they have committed in Gaza. According to colleagues on the ground, they're comparing it to what Israel did in Jabalia, north of Gaza, including the field executions, including the displacement of families at gunpoint, forcing them to escape their homes and creating a corridor, a humanitarian corridor from the camp to the outside of the camp for families to leave, giving them until the end of today or else. And this is what the soldiers would tell families, leave or else.
Mariam, could you talk about the impact of the fact that on his first day in office, President Trump lifted Biden-era sanctions against Israeli settlers accused of violence against Palestinians. It was on that day itself that Israeli settlers stormed several villages in the occupied West Bank. If you could respond to that decision by Trump and what impact it's had on the ground.
Of course, what we're seeing with Trump's swearing in the day after is an emboldened Israeli regime. And let's remember that in his last term, President Trump had declared Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, which further pushed settlers to basically rampage through Jerusalem and the West Bank at unprecedented levels of violence against Palestinians. So what we're seeing from the Palestinian end in regards to Trump's inauguration again is a fear that settlers are going to even feel more emboldened, especially in light of the impunity that Israel has, despite the genocide it has committed in Gaza. Because as of now, we haven't seen any real accountability measures against war criminals, Israeli war criminals. So Palestinians are frightened, while on the other hand, we're seeing settlers celebrate President Trump. In fact, in the E1 area near Jerusalem, settlers are calling for the renaming of some settlement blocks in honor of Trump as Trump blocks. So we're seeing the discrepancy here and disparity and the likely violence that may erupt in the coming weeks and months.
I wanted to ask the effect of the Trump presidency right now and how it is affecting what's going on there. You have the choice to become the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, former Congress member Lee Stefanik, refusing to say Tuesday whether the Palestinian people have a right to self-determination. She made her comments while she was being questioned by the Senate Foreign Relations, Maryland Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen, who said— she said that Israel has a biblical right to dominion over the occupied West Bank. So we're talking about annexation of the West Bank. What does that mean, Mariam, for the people of the West Bank?
It means more displacement. It means pushing Palestinian families out of their lands. And we're seeing this increase. The level of outposts being erected in the last 15 months has been unprecedented. And at the same time, primarily the American government, in support, with support from Europe as well and Canada, they have left the Palestinians completely defenseless. Palestinians are not allowed to have an army. Palestinians are not allowed to confront Israeli soldiers that are invading their homes. Now, we must remember that the Israeli military is carrying out an offensive on Jenin, which is in the West Bank, which Israeli presence is deemed illegal under international law, and the UN has voted as Israel being illegally present in the West Bank and Gaza. So what that means is more violence, but also it's sinister in that the continued arming of Israel with D9 bulldozers, with Blue 109 bombs, and then the stripping of Palestinians, not just of the right to self-determination, but any capacity to survive. Things like not condemning the cutting off of water from families or electricity or denying the medical capacity and access. It's a very slow slaughter of Palestinians. So if you survive a bullet, you don't know if you're going to survive daily life.
And Mariam, could you also talk about, you've written about this, the fact that this Operation Iron Wall coincides with the longest and most lethal campaign by the Palestinian Authority also on Jenin.
Yes. Yes. So what we're seeing in this operation, which the Israeli military spokes released a statement today saying it is the most advanced operation of its kind in the region and in the area. What we are seeing is direct coordination and collaboration with the Palestinian Authority, which has arrested journalists in the past few days who have covered Jenin, and they have arrested resistance fighters, and we have heard reports of them facing torture at the hands of the Palestinian Authority. Now, it's really important to recognize that Operation Iron Wall comes just a day after the Palestinian Authority allegedly ended its six-week-long siege on Jenin refugee camp, where they cut electricity from families, where they denied them access to medical care and even targeted medics in a similar fashion to Israel. So what we're really seeing is a proxy army for Israel and the Israeli army really targeting Palestinians in the West Bank right now who have no one protecting them, essentially, other than the small groups of resistance fighters who are realistically no match to the power and technology that Israel has and the coordination with the Palestinian Authority.
Mariam Barghouti, do you think Israel is using the siege on Jenin to indirectly break the ceasefire deal in Gaza?
No. What we also need to remember is that even before October 7th, Israeli officials and politicians, as well as military commanders, were calling for a large-scale invasion of the West Bank. This has been a procedure that has been placed in effect long before October 7th. It has also, we do know that this operation was planned in tandem with the ceasefire negotiations, so we know it is pre-planned. But it's also important to recognize that the ultimate goal of Israeli colonial practice is to push Palestinians out. So it doesn't necessarily have to be an obstruction to the ceasefire, but it does act and align with Israel's overall goal.
Mariam Barghouti, we want to thank you for being with us. Palestinian writer and journalist based in Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. We'll link to your new article at Dropsite News. Israel invades Jenin days after signing Gaza ceasefire. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warren, Afterina Nadura, Sam Alkopte, Maria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Hannah Elias. Our executive directors, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Ozbeck, Emily Anderson, Dante Torrieri, and Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. To sign up for our daily digest, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Renaissance Coffee is open at SFU. Prime Minister and his team have been serving the SFU community with great coffee for more than 20 years. If you're looking for a wholesome meal, delectable desserts, or something to warm yourself and lift your spirits, Renaissance Cafe is a place to be, featuring fair trade espresso beverages and brewed coffee. Renaissance Coffee is open Monday to Friday from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. Well, how do you get up and go?
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.